Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're going to delve into some legal terms in the news lately surrounding the cases of Jeffrey Epstein and his partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, and the Trump administration's handling of those two cases. We'll be breaking down terms like immunity, clemency, pardons, commutations. We also will be giving you a quick look at Maxwell's current attempt to get the Supreme Court to review her conviction and her 20-year sentence. Judge Gail, let me maybe just set the stage a little bit for our listeners without getting into too much detail. I think anybody who's been following the news lately know that there's been turmoil over the release of the Epstein files, especially a client list from the Department of Justice and the FBI. They put out a memo saying there was no client list for the noted sex trafficker. But before that, they said there was a client list, so that raises all kinds of public scrutiny. A weird thing, weird in the sense it's not normal. The Justice Department sent down Todd Blanche, the assistant attorney general and former attorney for Donald Trump, to do a day and a half interview with Ghislaine Maxwell. She's also being asked to testify by the House Oversight Committee. Now, she was convicted in 2022 as conspiring with Epstein to sexually abuse minors. And as I said, she was sentenced to 20 years. Well, interwoven in all these legal maneuvers are terms like clemency and immunity and pardons and commutations. And I think we would be doing a great service to our listeners to try to define those terms and put them in the context of the facts that are going on in the news. So, Judge Gail, can you give us a start and talk about immunity? Because that's a term that we hear a lot about, but we don't know much about. And there are different types of immunity.
Indeed.
You as a former prosecutor, you should be aware of those. So help us out.
Absolutely. And I was just going to say that the term immunity is often used, I think, in the media as kind of shorthand, as if it covers everything. And the fact is that there are different variations and different forms of immunity that's worthy of us talking about here. But let's just start with the brief overview of generally when we're speaking of immunity in terms of its legal implications. We're generally talking about some kind of legal exemption or a protection of some sort from some form of legal action, which would likely take place in the future, or some type of legal liability that an individual may currently be facing, but may or may not be formally facing at the time. Now, as I said, and as you said, Judge Tom, this can take many different forms, meaning the form of immunity can present itself in a lot of different ways. But more generally speaking, what we're often talking about when we're talking about immunity is like some form of exemption from prosecution, criminal prosecution, or liability for or culpability of one's actions or behaviors inside of a criminal matter, or sometimes even a civil matter. And this is generally what is intended when speaking about what immunity is. Now, immunity can be granted in a lot of different ways. It can be granted as a function of the law. It could be part of an agreement that's made either before or sometimes even after a criminal investigation or a formalized charge has been made. But also understand that there are forms of immunity that exist that are constitutionally granted. There are constitutional provisions and statutes that provide for forms of immunity, which I'll review in a second. But then there's also the form of immunity that I think we've heard perhaps most often bantied about in the news, which is the type of immunity that is garnered through agreements, like prosecutorial agreements or forms of immunity in exchange for something, or forms of protection or shielding from liability in exchange for something. And as you describe here, it's the testimony of the defendant or the convict in exchange for additional information, which could not be presumably otherwise procured through the primary actor who is deceased, having taken his own life in this case. Now, when we talk about types of immunity, I'm just going to go through and maybe label the types of immunity and then just talk a little bit about what those are.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Can start with perhaps the nuclear option, which is absolute immunity. And so absolute immunity from a legal standpoint is designed to provide someone with complete, total, absolute, hence absolute immunity, protection from legal actions, regardless of the circumstances. And so it is intended to be that, I mean, literally, it's like the force field. If you're a Star Wars fan like me, it is the force field, essentially, that you put around someone and they are protected from anything that can happen to them legally, no matter what the circumstances are, in exchange usually for something. Now, you usually see this with, government officials or, legislators, usually for acts that are taken within what we call the scope of their responsibility or the scope of their authority. So they are immune. Judges are often immune they are protected with absolute immunity from legal liability based on their ruling. So you can't go suing the judge or criminally prosecuting the judge because you don't like the sentence that they handed down in a particular case. And so this is what is known as, again, absolute immunity. Now, again, this is very common, and this is something that is usually, like I said, reserved for government and high-ranking officials. Now, another form of immunity is qualified immunity. Now, qualified immunity tends to be a tool used more often by prosecutors or law enforcement in the scope of either prosecuting or investigating criminal activity. Now, this often is used as well to shield government officials from civil damages. And that's unless their conduct clearly violates some statutory or constitutional right, but they usually enjoy this kind of immunity as a function, again, of their position. We often hear discussions about qualified immunity, Judge Tom, when we're talking about law enforcement.
Right.
We've heard a lot about that and how perhaps the time might be ripe to revisit the breadth and scope of qualified immunity for law enforcement activity, even when they are allegedly acting within the scope of their authority. It is not always appropriate, but again, I think it's becoming a situation where the timing is becoming more and more ripe to have those discussions. I want to say, just as an aside, if I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, I want to say at some point it was Senator Cory Booker and Senator Tim Scott that at least at some point, maybe this was a term or two ago, had been working on a piece of legislation that I guess the hope was that it would have addressed qualified immunity. But yeah, obviously, since this is not the law, and I don't believe there's a lot of traction that was made in that regard. But I think the sticking point was qualified immunity.
Right. There wasn't. There is no law. It's all by agreement, unless you're in a position that carries with it immunity, the absolute immunity that you discussed.
Indeed. And so then there's the thing called sovereign immunity. Now, sovereign immunity is actually more so designed to protect government agencies as opposed to individuals. So what we've talked about before with regard to qualified and absolute immunity, those are immunities that are designed to actually protect the behavior of the individual acting in a certain capacity or just possessing a certain capacity, such as a high-ranking governmental official. Sovereign immunity actually refers to government agencies that are also protected from lawsuits unless they consent to being sued. So this is, you know, something that is enjoyed by agencies throughout the federal government, but also state and local agencies, believe it or not. So you may not be aware that your state and local government enjoys what we call sovereign immunity, which again shields them from being or protects them and their agencies from lawsuits.
Your county or your
mayor's office, your city council, right. And the like, they enjoy sovereign immunity. Tracking along that is a thing called legislative immunity. Now, this, again, is kind of different from absolute and qualified in that it is specifically designed to protect legislators from any liability that they might face when they're taking action during legislative proceedings. And I'm sure there are so many people out here in our listening audience that, you know, kind of perhaps wish that that didn't exist, because depending upon how you feel about certain lawmakers and certain decisions they've made or certain things that they've supported, you are probably, you know, having some anxiety over, you know, them enjoying this legislative immunity, but they all get it no matter, you know, what side of the aisle they sit on and what it is that they are advancing. Again, unless it is in clear violation of a constitutional right or some statutory right or statutory law. There's diplomatic immunity, which provides for and protects foreign diplomats from jurisdictions of the host country. And so if there is a diplomat from a foreign country in the United States, believe it or not, they are in fact protected from prosecution and protected from the jurisdiction of the host country while they are in the host country. As an aside, I think I wanted to say, I remember there being a case in Washington, D.C. where a diplomat hit a pedestrian or ran someone over
with a vehicle.
Yes, with their vehicle. And they were immune from prosecution because of the trigger in the diplomatic immunity clause. Right. So it protected them from being able to be prosecuted, even though I think the victim lost their life. And so it was a really big deal because, again, the host country cannot impose its jurisdiction on a diplomat. The last one I want to talk about is witness immunity. Witness immunity is kind of where we are with regard to convict Maxwell, in the sense that she would now be a witness. She's been prosecuted already, but witness immunity actually protects witnesses from further prosecution or future prosecution, and is often based on their testimony. So you may have, when you listen to our prior podcast, whether it's about, you know, just generally how the court process works, or even more specifically when we talked about the several witnesses testifying in the Sean Diddy Combs case, many of those witnesses may have been provided immunity from prosecution based on what would be perceived as their own bad acts. And so essentially what the prosecution is doing and has done is encouraged a witness to come forward and to testify as long as they testify truthfully and fully, and they remain fully cooperative, because these are often linchpins in the agreement, is if in fact they do, no matter how bad the information is, and the prosecution will already anticipate what that is, there's an agreement that that individual will not be prosecuted either more if they've already been convicted and prosecuted, so they won't face additional charges, or if they've not been prosecuted but maybe been investigated and they've not been indicted, or if they have been indicted, the prosecution can agree to dismiss the indictment or dismiss the charges, but they can also agree not to indict or not to prosecute or not to charge the witness in exchange for cooperation in a criminal investigation. And so witness immunity is usually reserved for criminal cases, although it may, there may be some benefit in some civil cases as well.
Let me jump in here, if I could, and say that when the Department of Justice, when Todd Blanche, the Deputy Attorney General, went down to Florida to interview Ghislaine Maxwell for a day and a half of questioning, it was reported in the news that she received limited immunity from the Department of Justice to answer questions about Epstein's child sex trafficking ring. Now, is limited immunity the same as witness immunity as you've defined it?
Here's what I'll say is this Justice Department is moving in a way that I rarely see a Justice Department or a prosecutor's or a district attorney's office move or operate. And so just like I think we were introduced for the first time in our lives, maybe around 2014 or so, 2016, to the phrase of alternative facts, I don't know where limited immunity necessarily comes in, except for, in my view, you either grant the immunity or you don't. You either have the goods or you don't. You either know what you're going to get or you don't, and you make a deal based on that. I can only presume that limited immunity could shield the defendant or the convict from some future prosecution without promises to shield them from all future prosecution. And perhaps that's dependent upon the level of cooperation that the government receives and that the government is satisfied with. Because remember, this is kind of a two-pronged thing. You can cooperate, right, but they may not be satisfied with your cooperation, or they may not be satisfied with your level of cooperation, which could also vitiate the deal.
So limited immunity would be more like what you talked about, witness immunity, but it might have some elements of absolute immunity or involved in that as well, if it's part of the agreement, correct?
Absolutely correct. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let me give you another example here as we continue to talk about the whole concept of immunity. The House Oversight Committee subpoenaed Maxwell to testify in the month of August. And her attorneys, who I think right now are doing a brilliant job defending her, They sent a letter to the House Oversight Committee saying, you know,
by the way, you only say that because you're a former defense attorney, but go ahead, I'm going to give you that one.
They sent this letter, and in the letter they said, you know, our client's going to plead the fifth, the right to remain silent. Anything she said might be used to incriminate her. And so, but we want to cooperate with you, committee. So here are our conditions. One, you grant her formal immunity, term that we haven't heard.
Which I think is probably more akin to absolute.
Right. Interview cannot happen at her correctional facility. The interview should not be scheduled until after the Supreme Court decides her petition. And we're going to file a habeas corpus petition. And, okay, give me your one sentence definition of habeas corpus. You do that so well.
Well, habeas corpus is one of those Latin terms, right? It just means to free the body. And
so she's going to make a petition to get out of jail is how that's interpreted.
She wants to be, she wants her, the body to be freed. So corpus, if you think of corpse, the body, and they essentially want that person either brought before a judge or a tribunal
free
to secure their release. Free the body.
So they're saying you can't talk to her until after all of this.
Until they free the body.
Right. We want the questions ahead of time. And, oh, by the way, if we receive clemency from the president, we'd be willing and eager to come in and openly and honestly answer each and every one of your questions. If you don't agree to all of this, we're going to plead the fifth, and nothing's going to transpire that's worthwhile. So now all of these are negotiating terms at this point. The House Oversight Committee has said, we're not going to give you the questions. We can talk about some kind of immunity, and it's not up to us to give clemency. So let's talk about some formal immunity.
Although there does seem to be a for sale sign on the front of the White House. So if you can get it done, you might be able
to. So there's limited immunity from what the DOJ did. And now we get the term formal immunity. Are these just shorthand ways the media tries to explain what we're trying to explain, which is a highly complex aspect of the law?
I do believe so. And I think that the media, first of all, for, you know, lack of formal legal training, I'm not sure that they really know to connect these or to make this make sense to their audiences or to make it make sense to themselves. But I absolutely agree with you. I think this is kind of their way of interpreting, if you will, these complex legal concepts and to putting them into, you know, really short bites, because you only have a certain amount of time to convey this information. So they put them into bites that they believe their audiences will better understand. What I think it does, quite frankly, is it makes a complex situation a little more complex and confusing when you don't use the correct terminology and just take a minute to explain it.
It does. And I've been reading news reports in preparation of us talking about this. I've been reading a lot of them, and they just toss out these terms, you know, and as a journalist, this hurts my heart. You
know? So what the hell is that? What is that?
Toss out limited immunity. Well, okay, I'm going through my list of immunities that you went through earlier. Where does that fit? Formal immunity. Oh, my. Where does that
What is that?
Fit? What you is know, that? What,
yeah. There are actual terms of art that define the different types of immunity, and they are specifically delineated to go in and kind of substitute those for what I think the media may, in their view, think are just synonyms, right? So, you know, limited immunity is just the same as witness immunity. Yeah, that sounds about right. Go with that. And formal immunity, well, that sounds akin to maybe absolute immunity, or maybe it's sovereign immunity. Not sure, but you know what? We'll ask our audience to use their context clues to figure it out. Well, more people than not aren't familiar with it. And so they don't know the true terms of art. And by introducing these new terms, I think, again, it just creates more confusion than it does definitive understanding.
So when we are talking about immunity, would I be correct that it is something that can be given by the government, whether it's Congress or a prosecutor or the Department of Justice, given by the government, but usually in agreement with the witness that is seeking the immunity? Would that be a correct characterization?
I would say that is a correct characterization in some instances, but not all. Remember, there are some forms of immunity that are just
statutory,
automatic.
Diplomatic, sovereign immunity.
Sovereign,
but
yes.
As it relates to a witness.
Correct. It is absolutely within the power and purview of the government to decide the terms, conditions, and triggers upon which the immunity works. That's why You know, you can always have an individual to request it in exchange for something, because remember, even, you know, some forms of prosecution, you know, exact a form of quid pro quo. You want something from me. That's really nice.
There you go with
nice.
That Latin again.
That's it's that give and take. You want something from me, and that's really nice. And thank you for that, because I want something from you, government. I want
protection.
X, Y, and Z. I want immunity. I want exemption from prosecution. Matter of fact, if you're already prosecuting me, I want you to dismiss this and walk away from it if you believe what I have to give you is just that valuable. And in some instances, it truly is. Consider all of the cases against the mafia that the government was able to successfully prosecute. Much of them, many of them, would have been completely unsuccessful without some form of immunity or protection being granted. Now, remember, immunity isn't the only tool that the government has, but it is a powerful tool that can be used to exactly
just
what you want.
Just an example, somebody in an organized crime case could have immunity and say, I killed John Doe.
Oh, absolutely.
But I did so at the order of the boss.
And, right.
And that person would be protected from prosecution for killing John Doe, but that information is used to bring a case against the boss.
And in fact, that not only is that information used, but that individual would have to perhaps be the purveyor or carrier of that information. They would be required to testify truthfully. Maybe from everything from interviewing truthfully with law enforcement, because you want to get the statement locked in early. You want them to be consistent. You may require that they appear in front of the grand jury in order to secure the indictment. And their dance is not over until they have shown up on the witness stand and testified if there's an actual trial. Now, there may be a plea based on the information that's provided, but if there's no plea and there's a trial, oh, you can best believe that the music for the dance is going to play all the way through and to the time the prosecution is satisfied. If there's a hung jury, so the jury doesn't reach a verdict, even if you have a cooperating witness who's received immunity, then guess what? If the prosecution decides to try that case again, then they're going to call that same witness back and they're going to make them do that dance again until they are fully satisfied. And if they are not, in the day that witness wakes up and decides they are not cooperating, all bets are off. And now they are facing perhaps murder charges for John Doe.
Okay. With all of that clear as mud, but no, I think we've done a good job. You've done a good job of clarifying, and our examples, I think people can understand. Let's complicate things further in the aspect of immunity.
Okay.
3 days after Maxwell's meeting with DOJ, and the skeptic in me goes, gee, I wonder if there was a connection between those two things. But 3 days after meeting with the DOJ, she files a request for the United States Supreme Court to review her case based on immunity. Now, let me go through this so that people can understand. The appeal revolves around a plea agreement that Jeffrey Epstein negotiated in Florida, and people call this a sweetheart deal, in 2007 regarding, again, sex with minors. The plea agreement said, and I'm going to read this, quote, "The United States agrees that it will not institute any criminal charges against any potential conspirators of Epstein, including but not limited to 4 other suspects." Now, Maxwell was not part of the 4 suspects. She was not part of that. But her counsel is saying that she was tried in New York in federal court not in Florida. And that prosecution should have been barred because of the language in the agreement saying, including, but not limited to, and that she should have been included in that not limited to language. So there's a question of an agreement in Florida. Does that take precedence over the whole country? DOJ says the Department of Justice says the U.S. attorney in Florida did not have the authority to bind other courts. So New York was fully capable of going after Maxwell as it did.
So does that make the agreement void or voidable?
Well, the DOJ says that they were not even aware of Maxwell's involvement at the time of the agreement, and therefore she wasn't included. That's another one of their arguments. And this is where it becomes complicated. Federal appellate courts across the country have been split on whether or not one prosecutor, say in Florida, can bind the whole country by an agreement. Or is it each jurisdiction, and that agreement is limited to one jurisdiction? Now, the Supreme Court is looking at this. Remember, folks, the Supreme Court launches its new term on the first Monday of October every year. So Justice Roberts set this matter down for a conference, private conference with the justices, all nine of them, in the conference room that's never violated by staff or anyone else, for September 29th. Now, that doesn't mean that they'll give their public ruling, but the justices will discuss it then and decide whether to take the case. Four justices have to agree before a case is put on the docket for briefing and argument. It is more likely that the Supreme Court takes a case where an issue is split with the appellate courts. So my question to you, Judge Gale, and really to both of us to discuss is, does her case have any merit? And do you think the Supreme Court will take this case, given its highly controversial nature?
Well, I think the Supreme Court traditionally shied away from high controversy. And
Traditionally.
I don't know that I can say the same for this Roberts Court. And I'll say even traditionally, you know, in the past, Roberts courts, when there was a different composition of the court, they kind of shied away, in my view, from ultra controversial matters. However, as you said, you know, it takes four justices to grant what's called certiorari, which is the approval to hear the case or to take the case. And I think, quite frankly, this one actually presents a considerable legal question that does need resolution. But there are lots of legal questions that are presented to the Supreme Court that require resolution, and they declined to take them. That said, though, the language of this agreement, you know, the ability for potentially one office within the U.S. Department of Justice that are, mind you, represented and scattered all throughout this country, the ability for one office to potentially bind all offices on matters that are unknown at the time of a pending case, that is a pretty considerable concern, I think, that needs to be addressed. The impact of it is obvious. When you talk about the language of this agreement, right? When you're talking about, you know, the immunity from, well, what they offered Epstein, apparently,
right,
which was, you know, any and all, not limited to, I'm sorry, the language of including but not limited to, at least at a first glance view, there may be some considerable argument that says she could or should have been interpreted to have been included as part of that, including but not limited to language. I quite frankly think whoever wrote this, whatever attorney wrote this, I don't know how far in their cups they may or may not have been, but it seems like it was someone who was not particularly adept at writing very clearly, so as to limit this kind of situation later on. Now, here's what's interesting is convict Maxwell has been incarcerated for a while now.
Correct.
Why does her legal team just now discover this language? Because obviously it's been here. It's been pre-existing. And why did it take a visit from Todd Blanche
from the Department of Justice?
And the Department of Justice itself, who's crying foul, by the way, and saying, wait, you know, we don't want one lawyer in Florida tethering the whole country. And that may be a viable argument, but why did it take a visit from Mr. Blanche in order for her attorneys to realize that this language existed? Surely they knew this before. Surely they were aware of this, and surely they were prepared for the impact of this. It just seems incredible to me that you're only now discovering this language and, as you put it, Judge, the complexity, the legal complexity and challenges that it presents by having such a poorly written piece of parlance in a document, an agreement that you expect to have staying power.
Well, we should add here that the Department of Justice took action against the lawyer who drafted this language, the sloppy language. The Justice Department Center for Professional Responsibility issued a report saying the attorney used poor judgment in giving a wrist slap to a pedophile. And also
agreed,
using such sloppy language in the agreement that opened the door for this kind of argument. Now, this really came to fore when that attorney that was disciplined, so to speak, or at least rebuked, was nominated by President Trump before a cabinet position. And all of this came out. All of this came out, and he withdrew from that position. So this just stinks from the beginning. It just smells of a sweetheart deal in Florida, which I think most people will agree with. But now Maxwell coming in on the coattails of this, and as you mentioned, Judge, with the timing of this being, what, 3 years or so after the original sentence, really brings up all kinds of questions in my mind.
This is a garbage can. This is an absolute garbage can.
It's another form of immunity. And we talked about all the forms of immunity. This one doesn't even fit in any of those because it had this including but not limited to four other suspects.
Indeed.
Including but not limited to, and Maxwell was convicted of conspiracy with Epstein for his acts of sex trafficking and sex with minors. Yeah, so from a defense point of view, I think her attorneys, regardless of their motivation, have a reasonable argument. I don't know that the Supreme Court will buy it, but, you know, I used to predict the Supreme Court's decision based on the law. Now we predict it based on politics. So I don't know. What do you think on this?
I am right there with you. I don't think there is any predictability to this. But I also agree that this was so sloppily and poorly written. I guess if there's one thing I hang my hat on is the idea that maybe, just maybe, just maybe, if the Supreme Court takes this, maybe one of the arguments will be, you know, something akin to a slippery slope. That, my goodness, if we allow one U.S. attorney who apparently is so full of themselves, didn't bother to even ask a colleague or somebody
to read,
you know, the janitor, can you read this for me? Can you, you know, does this make sense? I mean, nothing. Just and then I often wonder, okay, well, what did supervision of this prosecutor look like? Because for such a high profile case, one would have thought or believed that there were more hands on deck. And so something like this doesn't go out the door without several eyes being put on it. And so if there were several eyes put on it, then the, you know, the sloppiness of it, the poor crafting of this is not just the responsibility of the prosecutor who's perhaps handling the case, but is the, it now is a reflection of everybody who had their hand in the pile. If you reviewed it and you had any supervisory authority or anything, and you let this walk out the door like this, then you're just as responsible as the person who signs the motion or who signs the agreement itself. In my view, you are. And so my hope is, if the Supreme Court takes this, that they can understand the fact that if an interpretation is that, you know, this is okay, and that, you know what, the prosecution, the government just has to live by the words they write, that this could really create a slippery slope whereby you could have a single district attorney's office or a U.S. attorney's office in a single jurisdiction that has the power or the ability to essentially tether the entire agency by with the writings of one agreement to a single defendant in a single case, where you may have other complicit parties you are not yet aware of that essentially receive, you know, pre-prosecution deals, they have pre-immunity deals. Yeah. And that could be horrible for a law enforcement and for efforts to hold some of the worst folks accountable for, I mean, just absolutely monstrous behavior. That to me is a slippery slope that I would hope the Supreme Court, I would hope that's a corner they can see around, and that they would say, nope, that's a corner we don't want to turn. That's a bridge too far. That's a little too much. The fallout could be far more detrimental than we could ever even imagine. And so we cannot possibly see how this is an appropriate interpretation. That's fingers crossed.
The Department of Justice, with Todd Blanche's interview, this was filed 3 days after that interview. Could be coincidence, could be maybe some behind the scenes maneuvering. I should say that the defense attorney for Maxwell is good friends with Todd Blanche. And they've been colleagues and opponents over the years. So they know each other very well.
Well, isn't that special?
So that doesn't mean a lot in the sense that, you know, I was friends with prosecutors when I was a defense attorney. That didn't mean that I would get special deals.
I agree. And I have some of my best friends on the defense bar, your present company included, but yeah.
But it's a question mark. It's a question mark.
It's part of the garbage can. It's part of the fumes coming out of the garbage can, because it doesn't look, and this is the ethical obligation of every lawyer and judge, right? To avoid even the appearance of impropriety.
Right.
It doesn't have to actually be improper, but if it appears or looks that way, then that is your duty to avoid even what appears to be improper. You know, I'll say as an aside, you know, when I was a prosecutor, some of my best friends were on the defense side. In fact, one of my best friends in the whole world, he used to actually throw my boyfriends out of the dorm in undergrad, was a defense attorney. But when I became a judge and he remained a defense attorney, one of the first things we agreed to is that he'd never take cases in my court. And not because he wasn't good at what he did, but because we wanted to
avoid the appearance.
That we always avoided the appearance of impropriety. Whether it was or wasn't didn't matter. We did not want it to even appear that this was something, that there was something improper. And this is what should have happened here.
Let me bring up this, and this is where I was going with my statement. And that is, if the Justice Department wants some kind of cooperation for whatever their motivation from Maxwell, and they don't want the president to get involved with a pardon or a commutation, and we'll get to that in a bit, they could have said, file this at the Supreme Court, and we'll sort of, you know, give you a pass on it. We'll take care of it there.
We'll give the president some cover and we'll take care of it there.
We may not agree with it, but we won't ardently argue against you and open the door for the Supreme Court. And that way, the Pontius Pilate example, they can wash their hands and be clean, because the Supreme Court makes the ruling. The president doesn't have to get involved with a pardon, and they get what they want out of Maxwell. That's my cynical view of this.
Thereby eroding faith even more in the justice system.
Yeah.
Bravo. Right. Bravo.
Right. So we just mentioned clemency. And as I mentioned, the one of the things for criteria for her to testify, Maxwell to testify before the House Oversight Committee, is that she have formal immunity, or that she be given clemency. Well, clemency is a word that really, my view of it is that it's an umbrella term. It doesn't mean much. It's an umbrella term that has underneath it two terms that do have meaning. One is a presidential pardon, and two is a commutation. Both of those equal clemency. So if the president ordered clemency, we wouldn't know what that was exactly. So a pardon is when a president says, this didn't happen. This didn't happen. You're free. You're not convicted. You don't have a record. I'm wiping the slate clean on this. Now, President Trump has not ruled out a pardon for Ghislaine Maxwell. He has not ruled out, in fact, he's actively considering a pardon for Sean Diddy Combs even before sentencing.
I just can't even, yes.
So that is the
ultimate. I'm so disgusted.
That's the ultimate. A pardon is the ultimate. It wipes the slate clean. A commutation is different. A commutation is when the president says, I'm not going to wipe the slate clean. You're still convicted of the crime, but I'm commuting your sentence. I'm making your sentence less. Basically, time served, you're out. You don't have to do the 20 years. And, you know, we'll just let you out right now. That's a commutation of sentence. It's not a pardon, but it's still within presidential power. Now, both of those put President Trump on the front line. And whether he wants to do this politically, whether he thinks it's advantageous to do it politically, or he thinks that it would rile his base to do it politically, there's one other aspect that the Department of Justice could use if they're maneuvering behind the scenes, and that is what's known as the obscure Rule 35. And that's where prosecutors can go to a court and ask the court to reduce the sentence of someone who has already been convicted. Now, normally, this is done within a year, But there are exceptions where it could be done longer. And as we've said, Maxwell's been in prison now for 3 years. It's a tough standard to meet. But again, it would be the Justice Department doing it, and the president can sort of have clean hands on this. The rationale is they ask the court to reduce the sentence if the defendant provides substantial assistance towards investigating and prosecuting other people. Well, the news reports say that Todd Blanche asked her about 100 different names in the day and a half. So are they building a Rule 35 motion as an alternative to a pardon or a commutation? That's my question.
You know, I wouldn't put it past them. That does not seem improbable to me. But one thing struck me while you were speaking, and you'll have to let me know what you think about this, is what I see as what is potentially the seemingly obvious or clear hypocrisy of this. Because when we're talking about, first of all, I think there's broad agreement that human trafficking, whether it is sex or labor trafficking or domestic servitude, is absolutely a horrendous crime.
It's heinous.
It is barbaric. It is violent.
But when you add that this was with minors, it's even worse.
It's even worse. It is absolutely worse. And this is exactly why, we punish the way that we do for these types of crimes. And quite frankly, human trafficking actually is a priority of the current administration. Combating, eradicating, dealing with, addressing human trafficking is one of the administration's priorities.
So unless it's too close to home.
Well, therein lies the problem, right? Because part of my issue while you were speaking was, well, wait a minute. This is a priority of the administration, which I absolutely agree, and I think it should be. In fact, I am not opposed to taking the worst of the worst offenders, especially, offenders who are either in the country on visas or they are not naturalized citizens and they are here without the permission of the country. Absolutely. Those should be the first ones out the door. And I do not disagree with that at all. If that is in fact the case, and in fact, I think I heard the president saying, the worst offenders that were already here and were U.S. citizens and they were terrible, that he wanted to, extricate them from their prisons and to deport them or to remove them to other foreign lands as well. So he's extremely adamant about protecting against certain crimes, whether it's, sex trafficking or murder, you name it. I think that that part, I think I can believe that is a goal and a priority of the administration. But I'm really struggling to understand how that is, how that can be, how that might even possibly be or remain a truthful or consistent priority if you could ever even consider any form of clemency, any form of pardon, any form of immunity. And let's be clear, this U.S. Department of Justice seems to be taking their cues from the White House. And so I'm struggling to believe that they are independent. Now, they may be looking to some degree to provide cover to some individuals, but I struggle to believe that they are operating completely independent of the direction of the White House. And if this is the White House's priorities, then how do we so readily look to other individuals who, some of whom, yes, are in this country without permission and are not naturalized citizens, and many have been deported without due process, and they've been swiftly removed, and yet we're willing to give just the keys to the prisons to what I think are some of the most heinous convicts, because convict Maxwell is a convict, has been convicted, is serving a term of incarceration, and is there for this very offense. So I will not call her defendant Maxwell. This is convict Maxwell. And if there is any conversation whatsoever, ever, about handing the keys to the jail cell to this individual is something that I think is flies in the face of what this administration also at the same time says their priorities are with regard to protecting individuals and protecting victims. I think it's the same holds true for considering a pre-sentencing pardon for Sean Combs. Same difference. It just flies in the face of what you claim is your priority.
Yeah. What message would that be sending to the, to it? It's counter and it's contra to the intent behind what they're doing with immigrants. It's mm-hmm. totally contra to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really struggling with how this is even a conversation, how this is a consideration. And yes, to the extent that we've educated our audience about what immunity is, what pardons are, what commutations are, and the like, how are we even having a conversation about any of these in the context of these individuals? Because I promise you, here's my belief, I promise you that if any one of them were foreign born or came from just a certain foreign country, there would be no consideration. For them at all. In fact, they'd be labeled monsters and rightfully so, right? They would be labeled monsters. They would be labeled pedophiles. They would be labeled, you know, animals, barbarians. And again, for the nature of the offense we're talking about, rightfully so, because that is in fact what you are. Trafficking is no more than modern day slavery. I absolutely get it.
Whether somebody's in a street gang or whether somebody is
in a country club,
billionaire country club, the acts are the same.
Yep.
The acts are the same.
The detriment and the impact is also the same. And how do you, in fact, honor, respect, and make victims whole by doing that, by even considering it? And in fact, this is another form of traumatizing victims and their families and their support systems.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to get your take, but also inform our audience. Our last episode, we talked about the Senate hearings on the possible nomination or appointment of Emile Beauvais to the Third Circuit, Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. We talked about the whistleblower and how he had told people at the Justice Department to not follow court orders and he had misled the court. We told you about all of that. Well, since then, he's been now dubbed Judge Emile Beauvais. The Senate agreed to his appointment to the Third Circuit by a vote of 50-49. So he's on track in a few years to be a possible nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. Thoughts?
I'm speechless, but I think this is what you proved.
That never happens.
Right? Given all that I've said before, but I think you kind of foretold or predicted that this might be the outcome. And I, on the other hand, I kind of held out hope that there would at least be more scrutiny. And so I'll tell you, I think I was mentioning, you know, a while ago that I think for the brilliance of our framers of the Constitution and for all of the hard work that they put into creating the Constitution, I think that quite frankly, this presents one of the failings of the Constitution because oftentimes these political appointments are made by non-lawyers, non-judges, individuals who have had and have no intersection with the justice or judicial system. And therefore are more aligned with and demonstrate more fidelity to and sentimentality to politics than they do the health and well-being of the judiciary. And that is concerning to me because although the Constitution calls for advice and consent from the Senate, when the Senate itself, again, is is governed. And I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. I feel the same way.
When rubber stamps without looking at qualifications.
Scrutinizing the credentials and the ability of someone to serve honorably as a judge is so necessary. I mean, it is so very necessary. And it just speaks to whether or not, in my view, these decision makers really take the health of the judiciary into consideration. And by that, I don't mean physical health, obviously. I am talking about the makeup, the composition of the judiciary. And we already, as a body, we struggle with the citizenry as a whole having vastly fast eroding faith and respect for the judiciary. And this does, in my view, no more than, you know, just pour gasoline and flip some match into what's already, you know, a burning inferno of, you know, lack of respect.
Well, this has not been one of our more uplifting episodes, but I hope it's been informative to everyone. How do people find us, and what do we want them to do once they find us, Judge Gale?
We are so grateful that you still tune in and that you have made us a part of your listening diet. And so we invite you to please check out more episodes of Next Witness, Please. We can be found on NPR, which we are so grateful for NPR's continued support and encouragement and partnership in this venture. But look for us on NPR. But you can also find episodes of Next Witness, Please on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or anywhere you find your favorite podcasts. And I want to encourage you to don't just listen to us, but make sure you hit the like button and also hit the subscribe button. When you subscribe, you are one of the first to be notified when we release a new episode. And we cannot be more grateful for your partnership and for your continued commitment to the work that we do in trying to educate you about the functions of the judiciary and the law as it works in this great nation. Thank you.
If you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to me, and my email address is hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. You can also use that address if you have a suggestion for a topic for us to cover. We'll certainly write down that suggestion and add it to our list of upcoming episodes. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media at Ohio University. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I'll be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.